Hello, Jeffrey.
Hey.
You got a haircut.
I did. Was time.
Yeah, it looks neat. Well, I'm not sure if anybody else is going to be joining us.
Dog's out and John's out. It's not Ed's kind of thing, I don't think, is it? TJ said I think he was coming though.
Really? To this?
He said he was looking forward to Friday, so I assumed it was this.
Maybe people are getting confused. I wonder if he was thinking about globes, as you were.
Globes is Thursday, not Friday.
True. Well, we'll see, I suppose.
Because I got confused about Slaughter Dick. I thought it was yesterday. So,
I'm glad it wasn't yesterday. It gave me a few days to get more into the rhythm of this book.
yeah, this book, yeah.
And I put aside Slaughter Dyke. I got far enough that I knew that I'd have enough time after this meeting to go back and finish that chapter. So I've been in the last week mostly just reading this book.
But all this reading is very demanding. I mean, I understand John's point of view. It's like, oh, you want us to talk about Stolen Mountain, but we're reading Sloterdijk and we're reading this and we're reading that. And it's like, how do you keep, it's hard to stay up with all the rhythms.
Well, he's partly responsible. But it's true. I feel that way, and Doug expressed, and I concur that it's a bit like a program. It's a bit like it, and I didn't intend that. It seemed to just unfold that way.
It sometimes feels a bit like I've got to read this, and I don't really want to feel like that for the reading. But it's okay to a certain extent because it gets you to the next point, and if I was reading it on my own, I'd probably put it one side and might not get back to it again for another year. So I'm kind of happy to be pushing myself to read through it, but read through these things, but it is a challenge.
I don't know what to say about that, because I'm I think there's a method to the madness.
I'm a bit worried about the Aurobindo, but because I think that's a very different writing style. Which I'm not quite sure about, but
Are you worried about the difficulty of the text or the pace of the schedule or the or something else?
I don't know. I just anyway, I think it's, I mean, I'm open to reading this text, but I'm not sure that I'm going to agree with it. So I'm sort of worried that I'm going to develop resistance as I go.
I have not read it at all. I have not read anything of, well, a few pages, just dipping in to get a feel for the writing style and the voice. And but other than that, I'm fairly ignorant of.
Oh, good, Donna. Wow.
Hi, Donna. Can you hear us? No.
Oh, dear.
Okay. Okay.
So it's not just you and I today. This is
But
special.
hopefully, we'll see. The reading is a bit of a conundrum. I mean, for me too. And there's almost like there seemed a gap between the ideal state of existence where I would have time to read these books and give them as much time as they really want from us.
Or deserve or whatever, yeah.
Yeah. But then there are, you know, other things going on that need attending to. There's some just temporal puzzle to and it's always kind of changing, and you know, you add things to it. People come into a conversation, goes in a certain direction. So, can we hear you now, Donna?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great.
Welcome. I'm glad you made it back.
Yeah, I did. Yep. But I have to confess something.
Mm-hmm.
I finished chapter 17 and I'm about to start chapter 18. I'm not as a good reader as you all. I mean, I've seen the conversation, but nevertheless, I said I will join as an audience and just, you know, give my reflections on the first chapters. But I promise next time I'm going to finish the novel.
When I saw because I'd lost track of the fact that the reading was on Friday. Well, I hadn't looked at the chapter list. I had thought we were still on 1 to 20. So I had
really?
4. And then when I saw 42, I thought, oh dear. So I read the rest between yesterday and today. So.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Oh, so you crammed. That's kind of, this book cannot be crammed.
There's a kind of a like you let go. You can't hold on to things when you're reading it, because there's lots going on and it's moving from one thing to the next. And so it's not like a story where you sort of hang on to something and you have a character and you can understand the sort of logic of it. It doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. So reading it all in one go or in spread out over time, I don't think it makes a lot of difference, really.
Mm. Have you felt that you could get into the kind of rhythm of mind of the narrator in the book?
Well, I saw your comment about it, and so I was paying attention to rhythm as I read forward, and I did feel that it sort of moves from that beginning space that a story has in about the first 15 chapters or so. Then it takes on its rhythm, and I felt that in the reading forward from chapter 24, you did find a rhythm that was not so evident in the first chapters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I want to ask how we might conduct this call, because we're not through the whole novel. I'm halfway through, Jeffrey halfway through, Donna maybe a quarter of the way through. Mm. It's hard to have a holistic perspective, you know, on it.
Mm.
And not that, you know, one could, or I would want to stand back and, you know, judge it or something like that. But, you know, any work of art has to be absorbed and digested, metabolized, you know, through one's own psyche. And it feels that, you know, we're it's a work in progress. We're in the middle of this reading process.
Mm-hmm.
And it also, you know, connects to other things that we're reading and to other processes. Just before you got on the call, Donna, Jeffrey and I were talking about all the reading that we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've been reading Sloterdijk, Peter Sloterdijk, Aaron Manning, various papers or essays for Cosmos Cafe, reading this. We're planning to read Sri Aurobindo. his full magnum opus, The Life Divine. And it can be hard, I think, to move between these different voices, because they're all strong voices, and they all have a particular world that they open up. When I'm reading this novel, what has been happening for me is that I feel like I'm being transported into this world of the Chinese landscape, the rural life of the villagers and their beliefs and their magical practices, and the author's observations and everything that's really encoded in and being transmitted through the work. It has this kind of background mood to it and an attunement. So I can't just read it kind of on very quickly on the go. I can't just absorb or extract like information from it in the way that I can with a theoretical work, like a work of philosophy. Sloterdijk is a little bit in between because he's sort of a literary philosopher. But when I read theoretical work, I can extract a schema of understanding about what the author is saying, what is their particular model or their idea, etc. And one of the qualities, I think, of this work, Soul Mountain, and of fiction in general, but I think that there's something peculiar or particular about Gao Jingzhen's fiction and the state of mind that he's expressing in this text, which is coming in a particular place in his life. I have to attune to it. I have to attune to it, and I have to kind of dream with it. What I was reflecting on as we were approaching this call, and I looked at your list, Jeffrey, of the key words that for you were salient in each chapter. And as I was reviewing the text and the things I've underlined or different notes that I've made, what I was reflecting on is the fact that I didn't know what to say about it. I wasn't even sure what had happened. It was hard to remember, like the episodes and I mean they were there. If I start reading the text again, I can enter back into the particular episode, a dialogue with the female person, or interaction with a villager, the ranger, or all the various things that happen. I can enter back into them, but like as if coming out of a dream, I find it difficult to recall them all and piece them together. And I wondered why that, I wondered about that. Maybe that is just poor memory on my part, but I think also I don't think my memory is that bad. And I think it also has to do with state of mind and attunement and mood. And when I've felt myself to be over the past couple of weeks kind of floating with the author's wanderings and his experiences, it's like you said, Jeffrey, I'm not really trying to piece together so much of a picture of what's happening, although in my mind I do have a map, and I'm trying to imagine where he's traveling to, because he names the names of different locations and mountains and rivers and so on. So I have a sort of accrued geographical aspect to my experience of the text, but I'm really interested in what I think is most meaningful to me so far is precisely this attitude or mood that the author is in, because it's so contrary to the digital type of experience, to theory, philosophy, to certainly to politics and the news. And he really, he understands himself to be an author of what he calls exile. Except it doesn't. That may not be an adequate translation. I've also seen the word fleeing. And in this book, he's left. He's left his life behind in the city, He's left the literary world. He's left his relationships, and he's wandering alone, really, really allowing the currents of life to take him where it goes, and then he's writing about that. And it's awakened in me a kind of almost a nostalgia for that sense of freedom. I think there's a sense of freedom in his mind state. But it's not freedom from suffering or from being afraid or from making mistakes or from passion, or like that's what's is coming, like all the stuff of life, right, that he's encountering is what is allowed to take shape in his experience. And then as a writer, he records that. And I've been listening to some interviews with the author and trying to find documentary videos or anything like that. There's almost nothing in English. He speaks French, so there are some interviews in French. And I found also a talk by the translator, Mabel Lee, giving an overview of the author's work and life and his I don't want to say his philosophy, but his way of writing, his understanding of what he's doing. It's making me reflect on what I'm doing as a writer, and where my priorities are, how I feel I'm relating to the kind of the given world, like the social world that we're in and the economic world.
So he is a painter too, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And if you look at his works, they're black and white. They're like water ink, watercolors. Mm-hmm. They're very nuanced in the sense of shading. You could sense that in some of the descriptions of the landscapes that he gives in the book, like the chapter 16, the mountain, and the way that it emerges from the blackness, and there's a faint outline of it, and that kind of distant, impenetrable intimacy of the darkness is and the form coming out of darkness. I see that in his paintings work as well. But I'm just getting to know him. It's like a whole another. It's a whole person, and it's like getting to know a person, their mind, their way of seeing the world, and I'm appreciating that it's slowing me down. And also I'm a little bit sick. I woke up with a sore throat yesterday, and I've been feeling overwhelmed as well with the different readings that we're doing and everything that I want to do and accomplish, in my life, through this Cosmos project and in all areas of it. And this is somebody who has a completely contrasting experience in this book, because he's let go of his life. And the experience of finishing this book for him, what prompted the completion of the book, he had been writing it for 7 years, had done all this traveling, and I think he ended up in France. I may not have the details correct on that point, but the Tiananmen Square incident is what made him realize that he would never go back to China. And so he decided to finish the book and start a new life in France. And so the notion that one's life is a finite thing, in a way, you can have a kind of life after your life. And maybe this book is the record of like a transition from one life to another, from his life in China to his life in the West. It's making me just reflect on where I am in my life and how that will inevitably change in some way, at some point. And how maybe what I really want too. I don't know. you know, I like this freedom. I like the wandering mind. I like to, and I've in my life, I've done a little bit of that kind of travel, but I was younger and I didn't have the kind of perspective that the narrator does here. And, you know, at the same time, I'm not in China. My life is good. I have a beautiful family. I have all the amenities I need. I have the mountains too. I could go wandering up into the mountains if I want to in Colorado. And I bet they're somewhat similar. And you know, I don't think there are any shamans up there. but you know, what is the life of a writer? I think that Gao, he raised this question, and but not theoretically. I think he raises it just through the example of his own life and his work. So I'm really appreciating getting to know it, and I started drawing. I'll show you something. This was just earlier today because I wanted to. I got this brand new notebook, a sketchbook.
Yeah.
And I'm not a visual artist. I really can't, you know, make. But this is the Chinese Lingshan.
Uh-huh.
I don't write Chinese, speak Chinese, never took a lesson in Chinese, but I copied it to see why is the thought moved this way? And that's all. I'm very much in the middle of that. I'm in the act. Thought in the act.
Wow. Wow. I mean, so many ideas. Wow. It makes me feel like, yeah, I have to go back and read. The reason why I didn't read many chapters or finish many chapters is that I felt this book needs that I have to be in a really a special mindset, you know. I just felt this is not just a book or a novel that I can just take it and read it quickly, like in an assignment and see what's going on, what's happening and the plot and this and that. I felt this is a book that I have to be ready to read it because I felt it's like it's a spiritual journey and I am now so much involved in this reality I'm living now in, deadlines, things to finish. And I felt once I finish everything and then I can take this book, it's like a sacred text, you know, and you have to just go through it. Because the first page, when I read the first page, reaching a station, a bus station, we always want, I mean, I felt myself, I always want a station somewhere that I reach this station and then from on forward, I would take this journey. And I just, when I started reading, I mean, the narrator and this character, one of the characters in one of my short stories, he's in exile, but in his hometown, in a city. I don't know if you can say it's one of those characters out of modernity. And he just takes this journey during the night in a city where he felt that he's not familiar anymore. And it's totally different from the journey here. And then it made me reflect, I mean, why my character was so in exile and why his journey didn't give him the sense that I felt the narrator is feeling here. So, I mean, for me, it was very interesting to contrast of and to talk to my characters and to feel my characters, as you said, as a writer, and to see why my character, is it because of the geography? Is China different from the geography I'm living? Am I reflecting characters living in this geography? In my geography China and this Soul Mountain. Do we have a Soul Mountain? Should I look for a Soul Mountain? You know, so many things, you know. And last night I was talking to a friend of mine who is, you know, writing a series for TV anthology. And he was telling me he wants to take this journey. So funny. I mean, to take from north of Jordan down to south and through these villages. And he wants to try, you know, to link the mythology that we have, the stories that old people tells and how this journey would change characters. And I was like, wow, tomorrow I'm going to have this conversation. Yeah. And I mean, that's sometimes, you know, signs, you have signs. And but yeah, I felt, I mean, every morning I take the book and I want to start reading and I say, no, this book, I shouldn't read it, like, you know, skim it quickly. Yeah, I have to finish it, because I felt no, because I took my time in the first chapters. It's not easy. I mean, he has written it out of his experience. And I think for me, out of respect, I should give it its, you know, its time, and I should read it carefully. And yeah, I feel that this is a man who has took his time writing this book.
Hmm.
Yeah, these are my reflections, I mean, so far.
I concur. I feel that too. Mm. That there's a different time in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he is deliberately seeking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, go ahead. No, I mean, even the language, when I was reading, I was wondering always, how is it in Chinese, you know? I just felt, how is it? How would it be in Chinese? I mean, you know, I'm reading the translation and it's beautiful from one chapter to the other. And then I thought, how is it in Chinese, you know?
I have the same curiosity. And
ah.
I got the idea, maybe I should order the book or something, or because I like, Chinese is Chinese to me.
Mm.
And I'm very curious. It has made me curious. Very curious. And it's so, anyway, I don't want to be too naive about it either, but.
Yeah. Because, you know, I've watched few Chinese films and I always had this feeling, I mean, maybe it's my ignorance, that the language might be like Arabic, you know, Arabic, a bit formal and rigid. But when I read this novel, I felt, no, it's completely different from what I had, the idea I had, you know, based on films I watched.
So I studied Mandarin, written Mandarin for a year, but I was, at the end of a year, I was only able to decipher a little bit headlines. That was it. And then I put it to one side. So it's very difficult to make progress. But I relate to your comments, Marco, about its ineffable, its difficulty to grasp. That's partly why I wrote the titles, because I got to about the chapter 13 or 14, and I said, I have no idea what I read. And so I started to go back to try and pull out these one or two word poetic images that kind of characterized the chapter. And then I kept going doing that. It gave me a trace of the journey. But I stopped trying to think it through at that point. I just, because I kind of enjoyed the exercise of trying to read through a chapter and try to figure out what is the image that speaks the most from this chapter. And so I sort of enjoyed that exercise. One of the things that I found in the reading, so I don't know if you folk have read other texts from Chinese or Chinese-related writing. So I've read, there's a series of books. They're not written by a Chinese person. They're written by a Dutch sinologist who lived and worked in China. And it's a series of 17 books, which are detective books that take place in 7th century China. The author's name is Robert Van Gulik, and so anyway, so I've read all those books. What's interesting is there are many elements in this book that are like echoes of Van Gulik's book, even though Van Gulik is describing events that happened 14 centuries previously. And so here you have this sort of lineage, a historical lineage inside the Chinese culture that is so deep. So a lot of the you know, like, for instance, at one point in one of the chapters I've just been reading, there's this talk about the fox lady or the fox woman. And the fox woman is a character talked about in the Van Gulik books. So it's this idea of a changeling kind of character or spirit, or people who take on the appearance of foxes, or who change into foxes, and these people move through the landscape. So there's a lot of these spirit or changeling or magic elements in the traditional Chinese writing. Van Gulik, his stories were based on actual detective stories, though were written in that era. But then he modernized them for a Western audience, is what he did. So there are many elements that actually date from or that are pulled out of Chinese writings and then presented somewhat differently. But so I do find these echoes interesting. And one of the things I've noticed in the reading, in this last section of reading, so at first it wasn't clear to me. The mountain you get early on, but the soul part wasn't so clear. It seemed to me that it was a lot of wandering and day-to-day life, but why was it called Soul Mountain? Why is the book called Soul Mountain? And now in the text, I find it's coming in more and more. Many of the chapters are dealing with, there was a chapter, I can't remember which one, that deals with Buddhists and a Buddhist experience. There's other ones that deal with, there's a lot that deal with women's menstruation, these kinds of issues, which are clearly a spiritual reference. There's things dealing with the sort of God of things that is characteristic of traditional Chinese cultures. And so, and the story, and about darkness, you mentioned that, Marco, the role of darkness, which is another element that I find really interesting. So there's a lot of echoes that are, so I'm not sure where it's going, but I do find the echoes and the resonances and the references really interesting. Mm. So it does feel like it is beginning to gather into something as opposed to just wander as it felt with in the earlier parts of the book.
Mm-hmm. I noted its intensification, and I think that one of the axes of that sense of things gathering is the relationship between the I, or the you, the I you, the first person in the book, and the she, the woman. There's a story emerging. We're learning something about her life story, and at the same time that we're witnessing these scenes, you know, from their relationship with each other and the kind of back and forth dialogue that they have, and this game, this kind of game that they're playing with each other, but it's a sort of high stakes game, it seems. And I don't know exactly what to make of it yet. I don't even know if it's real yet. He seems to have really met this person, but a lot of the dialogue and a lot of what happens might be his fantasy. But sometimes it seems like it is. And one of their lovers' games is to tell stories, and he will tell these tall tales. He'll make things up, but he also seems to have a wealth of knowledge about the local legends and customs, and you know, these kinds of stories that might show up in a medieval Chinese detective novel. I think he's coming into a world where the time hasn't actually passed, or rather where there's a kind of there's a fracture in timeline. The old world is still there, but the, you know, through the 20th century, the wars, the Cultural Revolution, it's being broken apart. And I mean, part of what I think what the point of his novel is, or why he wanted to do it, the political aspect, you could say, of the novel was specifically to draw attention to the aspects of tradition of ancient Chinese culture, but not just Chinese, because it's different peoples, right? different groups, and the Qian, the Mao, various others, which are distinct, even with their own language, their own dialects. And it seems important to retell the stories, to salvage them, even from the, what we know from historically was the, you know, the violent attempt to you know, suppress or erase all that culture. But what we see in the novel as well, in the interactions with the, you know, the different bureaucrats and the land management issues, there was that episode with the bus driver and the red armband police or whatever they were, and so I mean, I'm kind of a bit what's the word, but just flummoxed, or I'm not finding the right word, but my head is spinning a bit with all these stories. The guy, that the drum maker who's sacrificing animals, and you know, goes crazy at the end and dies. But it's one after the other, and they're so. There's one point in the book where, and I'd like maybe even to find the quote where he says, "This is real." He's reflecting on his own, and it's early in the book, right? He's reflecting on the fact that he's in that moment having a conversation with this person. There's a fire. The sparks, the embers from the fire are real. And it becomes a kind of spooky, almost. I'm going to try to find it since we can.
I remember it, this one, I think. At the beginning,
yeah, it's two, chapter two.
Yeah,
there are lots of spooky segments, actually, though.
Yeah,
there's he gets lost, he loses track of his guide in the mountains. He has that, wanders off from the monastery, and he loses track of where the pathway is. For the sake of just to bring in some of the text, I'll read the first paragraph. It is in the Qiang region, halfway up Qionglai Mountain, in the border areas of the Qinghai Tibetan Highlands and the Sichuan Basin, that I witness a vestige of early human civilization, the worship of fire. Fire, the bringer of civilization, has been worshipped by the early ancestors of human beings everywhere. It is sacred. The old man is sitting in front of the fire, drinking liquor from a bowl. Before each sip, he puts a finger into it and flicks some on the charcoals, which splutter noisily and send out blue sparks. It is only then that I perceive that I, too, am real. And then there's the story about Grandpa Stone. The hunter, these few stories come in.
That was a beautiful chapter, actually.
There's another paragraph here. I highlighted it earlier. He's talking about leaving his life in the city. He says, in those contaminated surroundings, I was taught that life was the source of literature, that literature had to be faithful to life, faithful to real life. My mistake was that I had alienated myself from life and ended up turning my back on real life. Life is not the same as manifestations of life. Real life, or in other words, the basic substance of life, should be the former and not the latter. So I don't know what manifestations of life are, but I had gone against real life because I was simply stringing together life's manifestations. So of course I wasn't able to accurately portray life, and in the end only succeeding in distorting reality. And then he talks about how he doesn't know whether he's succeeding, but he's here. He extricated himself.
Yeah, the point about literature, actually, and now I'm in this chapter, I felt that he's just contemplating, should literature be faithful to life, or, I mean, writers, poets, especially poetry, I mean, how faithful in depicting life. Everybody is trying to explain life, but you feel that literature is not, you know, or in a way depicting life, reality, the real life, what we're facing. I don't know. It was really, yeah. Or should literature change life, change reality? And it always kept me wondering when I was reading these chapters, did this journey really happen? Or, I don't know, is it a dream? Is it reality? Or distorting his reality? I can't say, because I didn't reach half of the novel yet, but it made me wonder from the beginning, is this journey really happening? Does he exist?
He doesn't have a name.
Yeah, exactly. He doesn't have a name at all. He's a pronoun.
Mm-hmm. But then again,
we are pronouns.
This is true.
Yeah.
The shifting pronouns is also part of why it's hard to remember, because the ground that we're reading, the way we're reading it, the point of view that we have to adopt is constantly
mm-hmm.
around.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite disconcerting in a way, I think.
Mm-hmm.
There was an excerpt that I picked up. I think it's in one of the later ones, but it's related to what you're talking about too. Whether berries wait for people or people wait for berries is a metaphysical problem. There are many ways of dealing with the problem, and it has been dealt with in endless ways, but the berries are still berries, and the person is still me. One could also say this year's berries are not next year's berries, and the person existing today did not exist yesterday. The problem is whether or not the present really exists, and how the criteria are established. Best leave it to the philosophers to talk about metaphysics, and just keep your mind on walking along your road.
Wow.
There's a lesson there, bro.
So, Jeffrey, you mentioned that you got a little stuck with your own writing at one point recently, and something about this book jogged your process.
Yeah, it's the use of the second person pronoun. So in one of my books, I tried to write from second person, and it was complete failure. But the third book in that trilogy by the same characters kind of called for another attempt at it. And so I found that having read this book, there's a kind of a way he has of dealing with the second person, which I find compelling. It's not an easy tense to write, point of view to write, and yet, and he doesn't use it only that. He switches between he and she and you and I, and so that's another way to break, because I think if you had, well, I kind of feel if you had only you and I, it would become difficult, but that if you break it up with another point of view, it somehow makes it a little bit easier from a reading perspective. But I do find this he's constantly addressing the you. And so I started to incorporate his way of doing that into my writing. And it kind of works. So for the moment, it's moving forward.
Who is the you in your book?
So in my book, it's an exchange between two characters, and the main character met the other character very early in her life as a young girl, and you know, became fascinated with the older character, but he rejects her. And so later on in life, they meet again. But because she has this memory about that first encounter, she's not inclined to give him any kind of benefit of the doubt. And so it starts off with a very sharp, angry kind of relationship between them, and develops from there. And so why it works is because in the first time I tried it, he was absent. He was just a memory. But now they're constantly interchanging with each other. And so when she says you, she means the person she's actually engaging with. And so it has much more of a presence to it. Now, Gao doesn't do it this way exactly, because in a way, his you is actually a memory, or I don't know, is it a real person? That comes back to this thing of is you really there, or is it? But it seems to be a kind of like you said, Marco, a kind of a story in itself, the UI, which is different from the he/she story. But I'm not saying I'm copying him. I'm just saying that there's something about the way that he approaches that use of the pronoun that kind of works for me. So, you're muted, Marco.
I was directing to Donna and asking who you think the you is in this book.
I mean, I'm still in the first chapter, but I mean, I don't know if my idea is correct. When I was reading the you and I felt the you is an alter ego of the I. I don't know if I'm right. I'm still reading, you know, but it gave me that sense that the you is an extension of the I, or is the alter ego, or is the mirror that the I want to face. I mean, I don't know. These are my impressions. Maybe I'm wrong, because this is based, because now when Jeffrey was talking, I was just thinking about my characters. When I write, I'm always afraid to explore the you. In my stories, there is always the I. And when Jeffrey was saying that he has a you in his writing, I was just thinking, why not to explore a you in one of my... I'm always afraid to give a voice to a you, or a he or she. It's like as if I want the perspective, or the I'm selfish. Maybe I'm selfish that my character is always dominant in my writings. But then I was thinking how Jeffrey is telling how about the you, and I felt maybe I should experiment in the you land more and more, and not to think of it as the you, like I thought for in this novel is part of the I, because I always in my universe that I create, there is only the I, and everything is part of the I.
What I found is that the you gives an intensity, it gives a kind of intimate intensity to the exchange, that this dialogue between you and I. There's an intensity, and it's intimate, and the book that I'm writing is about that intensity and that intimacy, and that's why it seems to fit. In Gao's book, I find that I'm not sure that... I think there are times when you feel that the you is an extension of the I, but it seems to me at other times the you slides into something else. I can't, I'd have to actually dig out the passages, and I don't think I have them referenced that way, but certainly in some of the recent ones where he's talking about violent incidences about women, the you seems to be somewhat different from just another I, but I.
I mean, I was just trying to think that you, at the beginning, because I'm still in the first chapters, I thought maybe the you is younger self from the I is the older self, and telling the story from a different time, and talking to the you like when you talk to the your younger self. I mean, I don't know. I'm still reading the first chapters, but these are my impressions at the beginning. But then again, maybe it's totally completely two different characters. I mean, I have to go through the novel to go through the journey. I mean, to see if it's there is a you and a and there is an and I. Marco, what do you think?
Well, I noticed that when I read the sections that are in the second person perspective, the you perspective, that I feel as the reader, as the one who's experiencing the language, the flow of the language, I feel that I'm observing. I feel that I'm observing the character and describing to the character what is going on for them. And sometimes, so I feel that the you is, I don't know, character might not be the right word, but subject might not be the right word. I mean, we don't quite have perhaps the exact philosophical like category for it. But who is speaking, I think, when the speech is in the form of a you address, is a sort of a, I think, an observer that is there watching what's happening, watching what the narrator is experiencing, and then commenting on it and describing it, commenting, and even directly addressing that character. It's maybe alter ego. There's an or alter observer. There's one more thing to that, and that's that Gao is also a playwright, and he has directed some of his own plays, and has also he works directly with actors. So. I was learning a little bit about that through one of the interviews that I watched or listened to. And so I can imagine that the you is almost like a form of stage, almost like a form of direction, where the director persona is directing the character, the player, who is taking this journey, who's visiting these locations and meeting these people and pursuing experiences. There's some kind of almost like a, and maybe it doesn't happen directly, but there's a way that somebody's orchestrating it, and it's not the you who's orchestrating, but the one who's saying you, the one who's taking that perspective is the one that is guiding maybe this, and maybe not only guiding because also reflecting back, maybe critiquing in a certain way the experiences of this person. Sometimes the I does something kind of dumb or gets into a conflict, gets into an argument, like the case with when he got stranded in the bus. So you didn't get to this point yet, Donna, but there's an episode where where Gao or whoever is on a bus that gets stopped by the military, the police. And not even the police, just some officials. And then he gets into an argument with the bus driver who ends up drinking because he's gotten a big fine. And I don't remember, I'd have to go back, to whether or not that's written in the you perspective, but I could see that narrator almost reflecting back what was experienced in order for the individual to learn from it, to not make that same mistake again. Thoughts on what that might be going on there. I have used the you in writing poetry. And in the case of a couple of pieces that come to mind, which I haven't shared, I'm speaking to myself. I'm either addressing myself, and it's a conversation between me and myself, and I'm addressing myself as a you. Or I'm speaking to a kind of cultural you, and a sort of pattern that I see in my peers, in us, and I address that as you, as an alternative or a more direct way of saying we. I don't think that that's what Gao's doing here. I think the you is himself. And who? What is his self? That's the question. That's a good question.
So you think the you is Gao himself? I mean, who's addressing you? This actually, when you mention it now, it bewildered me. Now, the first chapter we have I. I is Gao, or is the narrator, or is the main character, or what? And then you have you. Is I addressing you? Or is it the narrator addressing you? Or is it us, the readers, we're addressing you? Or is it Gao? I mean, it's like bewildering, you know, when I was reading. Who is addressing you? And then again, you go back, who is addressing I? And then I remembered like Foucault's article, What is an Author, when he mentioned Beckett, what does it matter who's speaking? And then I said, okay, fine, then I should read it. What does it matter who's speaking?
That specific article didn't come to mind, but that phrase, that there's an essay that Foucault wrote. What does it matter? Is that the name of the essay?
What is an Author?
What is an Author?
Yeah, it's like based on Death of the Author. It's in a way he took it to a further dimension than what Ronald Barthes,
Death of the Author. I read it in college.
Yes, me too. Me too, I've learned in college, yes.
But I wonder, just another possibility, the you could be us, the reader.
Yes.
And in a way directing us.
I felt this is very smart from him, you know, I felt that also.
Well, you said, Donna, that your characters also are going on journeys, but that the geography is different, the pronoun is different. What's the quality of the journey that your characters are going on?
Well, it's a journey of nothing makes sense. Leading a purposeless life. It's, you know, when you come out of like the wasteland, when you come out of this atmosphere of this you as a self, as an I, that you do not know who you are, what you're doing. It's, these are most of the journeys, and it goes back and forth. The times and going back to a different past, coming back to a present moment and reflecting, and the journeys differs, one during the night, another one during on the way to a grave, being buried and being going to be, you know, a character going to his grave, on the way, the journey going back to childhood and thinking and reflecting and wondering, and people around this character having nonsense talks. It differs, each one, each story differs, and another one from a perspective of a young child, but it's always I. That's why it made me wonder. I mean, I don't know why I was afraid of exploring the you.
Well, I don't think it's easy to write from the you perspective. So.
Do you travel within your country or around?
Yes, I traveled to different countries even, not just, I mean, I didn't stay in one location. Yes, definitely. I traveled to different countries and lived in different countries. But it's, I don't know, it's maybe reflections of characters I've met or a past life, something like that, in a dream. Yeah.
Do you write about the places you go to?
Not really. The place does not, I mean, it's not important for me, the place when I write. Yeah. So I don't describe.
Yeah,
the landscape or the geography of the place. Place has always been, I mean, even borders and places and geography has never meant anything to me.
That's interesting. And Jeffrey is writing a science fiction novel that takes place in a completely alternate universe.
So oh, wow.
This is a whole nother kind of place.
Wow.
And place is critical for me because because their future spaces. So I feel that people need to understand the place in which the things happen, because the place, in a sense, gives the character of what's going on. So I work hard on my places.
Do you have local legends and cultural practices?
Yes, definitely. I mean, we have written the first epic that ever human beings written.
Oh, no,
Gilgamesh.
I was talking about you personally. Or no, I was talking about Jeffrey. See, this is the perils of the you. Yes, no, I understand.
Marco, please define who is the you.
Ancient civilization.
There is an I. I think each one of us should take a you, an I, and a he or a she. I'll be the she.
Okay.
So what was the question, Mark?
Well, I mean, what is so compelling about this book is that it's so rich in lore, in this local folk customs. Like although he's an amateur, he's a scholar of cultures. And it seems that although he doesn't talk about doing research, he does a lot of research, a lot of reading, interviews. He's not just traveling like a tourist. He's really engaging in all the places that he goes, and part of what he's seeking in the soul that he's seeking, he's looking for in the places that he goes to. At least partly, right? Because there's some aspect of himself that he's working through. He's remembering his life. He's remembering his stories, even of his great grandfather and his father, and so it. I mean, to me, it was. I've had a kind of experience in my life where I had this sort of communion with a place, and where I went to seek some aspect of myself. And I don't know if I want to talk all about it. But it was a different kind of writing. It was the kind of writing that I did in the way that I conducted my life when I was looking to the people around me and the place the places that I was in. And I also traveled kind of in the mountains, and this is in Central America. That's where I was finding my soul. That was where I was finding the reflections of the self that I was seeking. And, coming after the Cultural Revolution and in the state of being an exile, I feel that what Gao is doing is finding his soul in the place, the places that he goes to, the very local, specific, particular parts of it. And you know, there's another aspect to his stance or his way of doing this, which I think is interesting. And that's the way that he conceives of the writer in relation to society. He doesn't have a program. Like, there is no self to achieve for him, I think, in this book, like in the sense of a career or, you know, publications. I mean, one other aspect of this, you know, of the writing of this book that he communicated and that I think is, you know, comes through is that he says he was writing it for himself. And so if you're writing, and I don't know, is that, I don't know whether or not to believe him exactly, because I imagine that almost every writer, even if they're writing for themselves, even if they're not trying to please an audience or a publisher, or you dream of other people reading your work eventually. You dream of it getting, being in the world. And, you know, but in this case, he doesn't, you know, he's at least entered into a state of mind in this journey, which probably, you know, maybe changes after he gets to France, but he's entered into a state of mind where he's not seeking himself in that same sense. He's seeking himself in the world around him and in what he calls real life, which he said that he cut himself off from. And that speaks to me, because sometimes I feel like I'm cutting myself off from real life in some way. Like, there's things happening around me all the time. I have my family. I have two girls who are constantly doing different things. I can walk out my door and wander around the city, meet people, talk to people. There is a whole world around me. And why am I not being where I am? Why am I not opening my experience to what's most present, what's least about abstract goal or an abstract idea of what I should be. I mean, that may be a fruitless line of thought, because at the end of the day, I have to integrate them in some way. And there's no kind of escape exactly that I'm going to take. But the idea that the writer really shouldn't try to change the world, really shouldn't even try to achieve something, that the writer really is just there to describe, to tell the what they see, what they experience, and give some kind of testimony to their existence, to their experience. I have to. That's very compelling to me. I don't know how to live that way.
But you don't really think that that's what he's done. I mean, there's a lot of artifice in the book. It's not just, I mean, the choices that he's made, they're intentional choices, because you didn't have to write the book this way.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it's, I think it may present itself as something kind of ad-libbed almost, but I don't think that's what's going on.
I agree about the artifice. I mean, he has said that he deliberately is using different techniques. He's drawing on modern Western writers, on ancient Chinese authors. He's deliberately constructing this book in a certain way. So there is the construction of the book, you know, the 7 years of writing and whatever I imagine there must be a lot more notes he took and drawings and all kinds of things that formed the kind of raw impressions of these experiences that he had. I mean, one other thing I think we could be clear on is that it is autobiographical. At least that's what he said, that's what the translator has said. I don't know how much weight to put on that, because really it's not autobiographical in the sense of that we understand an autobiography as a linear, you know, narration of the events of one's life. But it's, I know there are places where he's making things up, but I have a kind of faith that he's also telling what happened in the way that's true for him. And that even though it's a construction, a literary creation, there's real life that is being described. And that's really what he's artistically transmitting or portraying. But it's real. It's real. that's where I wonder, like, around how a writer, you know, how a writer understands themselves, like what they're really doing. You know,
come to the discussion we're having with Zachary or Johnny about their writing, because much of their writing is very autobiographical. And so, in fact, I was talking to a friend the other day, and she was saying, "Oh, Jeffrey, you should really think about writing something autobiographical." And I thought, I'm not sure I would go there, you know, because there's getting the distance right in terms of not being too close and not being too far. And I don't really know how to do that. But, and I admire people who do that, you know, like Zachary or Johnny. But Gal's book, his book, I'm not sure that I take it as being autobiographical in the same sense than what Zachary or Johnny are doing. I think this is, I think there is a point here. I think this is a journey that he is taking us on, and the journey is designed to take us somewhere. So I don't think it's a strict retelling of the things. I mean, I'm not saying I doubt that he didn't make those voyages. I think he did, and they did make those observations. As you say, he probably has copious notes from all the traveling that he did. But I don't think the story, the way it presents itself to us, does it even follow the chronology of the voyages he makes? I mean, does the movement from one place to the next follow the actual movements he made through the landscape? I'm not at all convinced that's the case.
I don't think so either. And there's something with the woman too. I think he really met her. It seems that he did. But I don't know whether he had all these later encounters, which come much later in the novel, where he's already in different locations. And it doesn't seem that she's gone with him.
And it seems like there's more than one she, because he talks about a woman, and you're not always sure that he's talking about the same woman.
Yes.
Because sometimes the background details seem to differ from one she to another. So
that's right. There's a lot that comes up, Donna, in the next chapters that you'll read, which I think are very interesting from the perspective of the relationship between the man and the woman and sexual politics and sexual dynamics and that kind of a thing. It would be, you know, interesting to discuss that, I guess.
Yeah.
you know, there's a lot of politics in here too. It's very subtle, but it's not outright making arguments against the Communist Party or what have you, but more in the sense of the minor gesture. That another book we're reading is called The Minor Gesture by Erin Manning. And the minor gesture, she contrasts to the major kind of, you know, big plan. Minor gesture doesn't look to be confrontation, doesn't look to be, you know, to fit into the way that discourse is supposed to happen. So there's a lot here that where I think he's making critiques of Chinese society, and things like, you know, gender relations, definitely, you know, the relation between government and the people, I think would be interesting to discuss, because, you'd have to read it. We'll have to do it next time.
Yes.
So what were the memorable particular scenes or characters or personages or events that...
There was one incident that struck me that I really enjoyed and that I find really interesting as maybe kind of a characteristic of the book, almost a comment on the book. It's later on from where you are, Donna, but it's a scene where
no problem.
He goes into a cavern and he encounters a monstrous form and then realizes that it's his own shadow. And then he has a companion and his companion has a monstrous form. And then they play with each other and the shadows. And so it's this very sort of humoristic almost scene with a kind of sardonic edge to it, you know? So it's like he's sort of saying, he's sort of stepping back and saying, this is play too, right? What's going on here? It's not just recounting what things are going on. It's actually play.
Mm. That struck me too, and it seems to be a sort of atmospheric phenomena that had to do with the mist, like that would roll over that in that particular location. I think they call it demon shadow. The locals call it demon shadow, something like that. But the idea that he has a lantern. And so when you put the lantern down, the light casts the shadow. But it's as if it's appearing as a manifestation right in front of you. And at first, he doesn't know that it's actually him. And his friend comes out. That was very interesting because it comes also in maybe a few chapters after the encounters that he has with these real terrifying, figures. There's that one with the eagle that appears. And he has some terrifying dreams as well. And some other, real scares in his experience.
Although there's the one dream about the darkness that actually seems to be taken up by the real, I don't know if it's a story element or whether it's really happened, but the whole incident with the woman and the blood and the fact that she wants to be covered in blood, but it seems to hark back to the dream about the darkness that he had. Seems to be connected.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wonder whether or not that conversation really happened. And if it did, though, it was really interesting woman, I have to say. Like the conversations that they're having, this back and forth and the tête-à-tête, and like they're going very deep. It's a very passionate love affair, it seems, that they're having. Dangerous in a certain way. Like there's a kind of emotional danger there. She's really describing her past traumas and she's so suicidal when he meets her.
And also the way that it's written, it repeats itself. The entire blocks of text that almost word for word repeat themselves throughout that. And so you're going, have I gotten lost? And and then you look back and you realize, no, it's the same text that is. And so there's something very obsessive or very insidious going on there. It is a fascinating. I remember my wife studied Kundera in she did a doctorate in literature and she studied Kundera, and part of her thesis was based on the unbearable lightness of being and books like that. And Kundera was somebody who played a lot with the I in his books. And I That's feel true. In some ways that this is post Kunderan in a sense. It's sort of a the next stage forward from that kind of attention to language that Kundera has in his writing, but in a different, a more extensive, more experimental in some ways, rewrite of that kind of preoccupation with nerds. It's one of the senses I got from this. It's also a green book. I don't know if you have a color, but when I read it, it feels like it's green.
There's a bit about ecology as well. And the ways that pandas are being poached or tigers can't be found anymore in the mountains. I mean, he's documenting part of that as well. One of the effects of industrialization and land reform and everything, that of course now is 100 times that what it was in the 70s or I guess 80s when he was doing this trip. But I see all these landscapes in my mind, and it's an outside book. It's the other thing. There's weather in the book. There's animals. There's food. Mountain climbing adventures. It gives me some kind of nostalgia or some kind of desire to be out like that.
And is there one mountain or is it really many mountains? Because we don't seem to actually encounter the mountain, even though it's kind of announced that way at the beginning. Mm. But maybe it's in the second part, I don't know.
It seems to just disappear. Like he was looking for Lingshan. It seems to be a real place. He's got a map from this person he meets on the bus. He has to go to Wuyiden first. And then he does find a place called Lingyan. I don't know what that means, but soul something. But after that, it seems to be traveling to different places. And according to the, what I've heard or read, he traveled over 15,000 miles. So there are vast distances that are being covered here and different peoples. But it does evoke that, and of course I live near mountains, so I can transpose one scene a little bit onto the other. And when I was in Central America, I was in the mountainous region, and so I traveled perhaps in a very similar way to the way that he did, on buses and with the local people, the rural people with their chickens and everything like that. I think part of what he's describing is common to rural life, a traditional rural. You'll find similar kinds of even similar stories, some different names, different gods, different figures and practices. But if you travel through Mexico, you'll find shamans or other medicine healers. You'll find all kinds of very weird types of practices that are not taken ironically. They're authentic. And so there's also this meditation on the, what's happened to these traditional worlds, and how much is lost in the forward advance of modernity.
And he makes no judgment about those things, the magical things. He could, but he doesn't. He sort of takes them as part of the natural world.
I think so too. I mean, there is that one episode where he's getting a fortune reading, and he gets cursed by the medium woman. She says that there's some kind of a red eye monster that is
good. Yeah.
And he can't get her to tell him how to be rid of the curse. And he thinks that she did that because he was not taking her seriously, that he was there for the entertainment value of getting a reading done. But aside from that, I sense that he sees, I don't know, like the natural value of different kind of cultures, different cultural practices. Like it's a natural phenomenon, I think, and he's describing it in along the same spectrum that he would describe the environmental phenomena, the mountains, the rivers, and so forth. These people are expressions of that same nature, but not purely, because you have this overlay of the military history and the political history, and it's a world that's dying, is I think what he's...
And you have some of these animal forms that take on characteristics that are a bit more than the animals would normally have. So I'm thinking about the Zhudong snakes that he describes as having this ability, before you even see them, they've already killed you.
Yes, so. I love that. I read that chapter to my daughter. It not to scare her or anything, just because it was the one that I think she would enjoy. Not as complex as all the others. So I don't mind. And you know, so sometimes we go a couple of hours. I'm okay to end, you know, in a little while here. And I feel sick myself.
Yeah.
And we have, I don't know what Doug will think. I don't mind taking my time with this. I'm enjoying it. I want to look, I want to learn, I want to practice more Chinese, just get my mind into that geometry. Do some more drawing. I'm curious what the Chinese characters are for you. And I and she. I know what they are for soul and mountain, and so I'm curious what they look like. And maybe just meditating on those characters will give some insight. I don't know. I mean, I need something to hold on, something to grab onto, because otherwise I'm totally lost in to the culture, the language, everything. I want to weigh in.
I have to go find my Mandarin dictionaries.
There's a lot too about how he has a perspective on the Chinese language. He thinks that it's been in a way perverted by the attempt to standardize it.
Yeah.
We talked about this a little bit last time, to standardize it for the sake of Western translations. And so we can't access this at all, obviously, but his intention was, and according to his translator, he is reworking the syntax of the language. And the way that he wrote this, he spoke it out loud, and he created recordings of each of the episodes, and then he wrote the text from his recordings. And the reason he said he did that was because he wanted to recapture or revive the musicality of the language, the sound aspect of it. So that makes me a little frustrated, because I can't hear it at all. I have no idea what it sounds like in Chinese. And although it reads very well, I have to say, in English. And I think that I was skeptical at first about the value of reading a book in translation. I mean, I've done translation. I have nothing, but I just wondered whether I'd be really missing something essential. And like, if I really want to read it, I should just learn Chinese. But that's not going to happen very soon. So maybe there's a recording out there we can find. If I find one, I'll post it. I found some things on his artwork as well that I can post.
There's some poetry in, I think it's chapter 41, or again, we remember the poetry, and I do, I sensed that the original would be more interesting than the translated version. Something about the it is more traditional, like poetry, and I don't know. It feels a bit. Feels like I'm missing some of its depth when I'm reading it, you know? So.
Poetry is always difficult to translate. I mean, you can translate prose easily, but poetry has always been difficult to translate. I mean, when I read a poem in Arabic and sometimes some people attempt to translate it into English, it's always difficult. One of my professors back in college, he attempted to translate Shakespeare in a way that resembles, I mean, you know, like in a way like Shakespeare been written in English. But still, I mean, it's difficult really to translate poetry. And you're right. I mean, it would be maybe different in Chinese. We can't tell how the translator, if he or she, I think he was able to translate the poem and maybe transfer not just the meaning, but everything, the image, the word. Sometimes one word can change many things, you know, in language.
The ideograms have images built into them, right? And that's, I think, why you're interested in them, Mark. Because I can't remember what it might be the word pi or something like that. It has a house symbol built into it. So there's a sense, you know, sort of, there's a relationship between home and the eye, if you like. So a lot of these characters have images. So I do feel that the poetry probably has some of these images that are in the ideograms, and they were obviously extremely difficult to translate because you're going to translate the sense of what is being said and not necessarily pick up those kinds of things. So there's a kind of resonances that I think are possible. But I mean, obviously, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Well, just phenomenologically, in my little experiment in writing, I can notice different things about how I'm orienting toward language. And this is just my first perception of it, but the going down and the kind of drawing and the multiple, it's a more complex curvature in the script, and it feels like you're drawing rather than maybe with, you know, if you get used to it, but the going down is different because I'm just thinking out loud here, but it almost feels like going deeper, if that makes sense. And this is just because you're going downwards. I mean, in the you're bringing something down instead of going across like this writing. And I don't know what that means, you know, from whether that changes consciousness in some way. But I think that these little things do. I mean, the fact a language that goes from right to left, one of the things that John Gebser pointed out is that with the mental structure of consciousness, things go from left to right. And he associates that with the predominance of left. He doesn't think in terms of the hemispheric brains, but with that rightward motion as the forward motion of mental consciousness. Whereas the leftward motion is a more conservative kind of past retrieving, past gathering. And downward is something different. I'm just noticing that the very way that one writes and reads could affect how one resonates with the text, the mood of it.
And the ideograms have a kind of a base structure and then there's higher structure. And often the dictionaries show you the different pieces that go into the ideogram. So you can see the pieces that go into them. And so if you can get a text with the ideograms in it, you know, but then you would need to get the original. You could do that. I used to translate when I first started learning French. I used to take books, and they were often quite challenging books. And I would go and I would write in the English word over each word that I didn't know in a book. And there would be thousands of them, even on a few pages. But I would do this painstakingly, word at a time. That's how I learned to read in French. And I did it more recently in the last few years with Italian. So the same kind of thing. And in a way, with Google Translate, we've gotten far too lazy. We don't do that anymore. But it, although it's painfully slow, it was a good way to learn, you know, so I can read Italian newspapers and I can even read Italian books. It's slow going, but I can, because I did this exercise but I can't speak Italian. So, but I'd sort of be inclined to do something like this with the Mandarin if one could actually get to the text.
Yeah. Mm. It'd be very interesting. Because then you could more see the grammatical structure as well.
Mm.
Okay. How are you feeling? You, both of you.
You, the plural.
Yeah.
We don't have a pronoun for you all.
Yeah.
Like in Spanish, you would say vosotros or ustedes. Mm-hmm. Another matter.
In Arabic, we have the I, and the U is dual. So we have duality in Arabic. So sometimes the U, we are addressing two. And then we have addressing more than two as a pronouns.
So you have a singular U and a plural U.
Yes, yes. Anta is Arabic, anta for singular, and tuma, it means both of you, and tom, it means more than two. Okay. I think, yeah.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, we recognize dual in Arabic, yeah.
I was also wondering if the fact that you write the other way around, so left to right, that Dunn's thought processes also work in some sense in another way, you know? So I have a number of Arabic students, but Arabic. I don't think there's any answers on that, but
yeah.
All right. I'm going to get going.
Yeah. But it's been great. I have a different sense of the reading. I think it's a good way to take the reading forward to the next step.
Yes.
Will you have time to read over the next month, Donna?
Yes, I think so. The next month, I think I would have enough time to, I'll try my best to finish the book. Yes.
Okay. I wanted to propose an experiment too. Not for any time soon, for, I don't know, a few months or whatever.
Mm.
I'd be interested in trying to translate a story from Arabic. Obviously, I don't speak Arabic, but you said that you wouldn't write in English.
Yes.
But I wonder if I'm writing in English and you're translating the Arabic, we could actually...
Wow, that would be really interesting.
Just a short experiment.
Yes.
That's all. I'm just.
Yeah.
It occurred to me last month, time we met, and I didn't have a chance to message you, or it was on my list. But now that we're here, I just wanted to plant the seed.
Yes.
I'm, and I also want, like I said last time, some kind of window into where you live and what's going
on. Definitely, and the culture and the people.
Where you're based, Donna?
Jordan.
Oh, Jordan. So you are?
Okay. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
All right. We'll see you next time then.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.